Rosenberg, who will be talking on historical and future trends in precipitation extremes and the impacts on the stormwater infrastructure of Washington State.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Thank you to Debbie and Dr. Edmonds at the Water Center for inviting me to speak, and thanks to all of you for taking time out of your schedules to be here today. My name is Eric Rosenberg, and I'm a grad student in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at UW. And today, as Jessica mentioned, I'm going to talk about a study that we just completed looking at past and future trends of precipitation extremes throughout the state and analyzing their implications for stormwater infrastructure. Now, as Dennis mentioned, this study was for the state of Washington under what was called House Bill 1303. Dennis did a good job of giving an overview of the whole project, and you can see that it covered a wide range of sectors with the ultimate goal of determining specific steps the state of Washington should take to prepare for the impacts of global warming. And the part of the study that I'm going to talk about is the chapter on urban stormwater infrastructure. Now, flooding has been on the minds of a lot of people in this region lately. Major events have occurred within the western part of the state in each of the last 3 years, causing widespread damage. In fact, this article appeared just last month in the Seattle Times on the heels of the floods that occurred in early January throughout the Puget Sound region. The article also stated that FEMA disaster declarations in connection with flooding have occurred 10 times in King County over the past 20 years, which seems like a lot. But while the link between precipitation and flooding is obvious, it bears emphasizing that flooding is not only dependent on precipitation. Of equal importance is land cover, and in fact, this particular article cites land development as the major cause for the recent floods. In hydrologic speak, land development is characterized by the imperviousness of a watershed, and those two terms, precipitation intensity and imperviousness, can be considered the main drivers of any shifts in trends in runoff. Now, the precipitation intensity has traditionally been considered to be constant, or more specifically, stationary. But this is an assumption that is being challenged by a changing climate. Stationarity is a concept that is literally as old as time. And here is the definition from the Handbook of Hydrology. A time series is stationary if it is free of trends, shifts, or periodicity, implying that the statistical parameters of the series remain constant through time. What this is saying is that, sure, you can have year-to-year variability in precipitation extremes, but the basic envelope in which those extremes fall remains the same. This is the basic assumption underlying the design of all infrastructure that depends on precipitation, not just stormwater infrastructure, but water supply systems as well. But as we will see, the concept of stationarity is not so black and white, and in fact, it really depends on the time interval being analyzed. Nothing is perfectly stationary. The real question is, how much non-stationarity can we live with? Now, in this study, we concentrated on just one component of flood control, and that is urban stormwater systems. Urbonis and Rosner in the Handbook of Hydrology place urban stormwater infrastructure into two categories. Minor infrastructure, which are the roadside swales, gutters, and sewers designed to carry runoff events of 2 or 5 year return periods, and major infrastructure, which are the detention ponds and larger flood control structures designed to manage 50 or 100 year events. Return periods are a way to describe the likelihood of a particular event. The 100-year flood, for example, is the flood having a 1 out of 100, or a 1% chance, of occurring in any given year. These standards may be slightly different depending on the particular region, but my point here is to provide a general idea of the types of storms that we're interested in. And we organized our study by three main objectives. What are the historical trends in precipitation extremes across Washington State? What are the projected trends in precipitation extremes over the next 50 years in the state's urban areas? And what are the likely consequences of future changes in precipitation extremes on urban stormwater infrastructure? Now, I'll begin with the first objective. Although most climate change research on precipitation has focused on changes in total annual amounts, which has incidentally produced much less consistent results than changes in temperature, as Dennis mentioned before, there are several studies that have looked at changes in just precipitation extremes. Most of these studies have found various degrees of increases in the frequency of extreme events throughout the United States over the last 100 years. But while these prior studies provide useful impressions of general trends, they have two main drawbacks when it comes to the engineering design of stormwater infrastructure. First, the minimum storm duration that they consider is 24 hours, but the storms that generally lead to flooding in urban areas are of much shorter duration due to the small sizes of the watersheds and the rapid flow paths for the runoff. Second, in almost all cases, the studies are focused on changes in the frequency of extreme events, when the most critical consideration in the design of stormwater infrastructure is changes in the intensities of the extreme events. An exception to this statement was a study published by Fowler and Kilsby in 2003. They used regional frequency analysis to determine changes in design storm magnitudes from 1960 to 2000 in the United Kingdom. And their paper formed the framework which we adapted for our study. The basic principle behind regional frequency analysis is that annual precipitation maxima from all sites in a region can be described by a common probability distribution after the data have been divided by their at-site means. Now, annual precipitation maxima are pretty much what they sound like. They are the highest recorded precipitation totals at various time durations in each year. The strength of this method is in the regionalization, allowing for a larger sampling pool of data and more robust estimates of design storm magnitudes, particularly for the longer return periods. Our study looked at data in the three major urban areas of the state: Seattle-Tacoma, Spokane, and Vancouver-Portland. The stations that we used for each region are shown here, 8 surrounding Seattle-Tacoma, 8 surrounding Spokane, and 7 surrounding Vancouver-Portland. Now, most daily precipitation records in the region go back about 100 years, but the hourly records only go back to about 1948, providing us with about 60 years' worth of data at best. And the three stations having the most complete records were at SeaTac, Spokane, and Portland airports, indicated in yellow here, and the results that we will show are specific to those three locations. Now, we analyzed trends in precipitation extremes ranging in duration from 1 hour to 10 days. To illustrate the procedure, here's an example of how we derived probability distributions for the 24-hour storm at SeaTac. On the left axis, we have precipitation depth in inches, and on the bottom axis, we have design storm return periods on a nonlinear scale. The highest 24-hour precipitation totals were calculated for each year in the SeaTac record, and these data were then divided into two time periods, 1956 to 1980, which are the blue dots, and 1981 to 2005, which are the black dots. The data were ordered by magnitude and plotted as shown here. The next step was to fit a curve to the set of data points from each time period. Now, in actuality, these curves were fit to the annual maxima from all 8 stations in the region after the data from each station had been rescaled. But for clarity, I'm only showing here the data from SeaTac, and you can see that the derived curves fit the data pretty well. Now, we can use these curves to compute changes in design storm magnitudes at various return periods. As you can see, the magnitude of the 5-year storm increased by 30% between the two time periods, and the magnitude of the 50-year storm increased by 37%. What this translates to is that the 5-year storm from the first period became a 2-year storm in the second period, and the 50-year storm from the first period became an 8-year storm in the second period. The change between the two time periods in the average annual maximum was 25%, which is roughly equivalent to the change you see in the 2-year storm. As it turned out, this particular change of 25% was just about the largest increase observed for any duration at any location throughout the state. Shown here are changes in average annual maxima at SeaTac, Spokane, and Portland. And although we analyzed these changes at 9 different durations, I'm only showing the results at 2 here. The 1 hour, because as mentioned before, storms that generally lead to flooding in urban areas often have durations of 1 hour or less. And the 24-hour, because that is the duration most commonly used for purposes of design. And as you can see, although the results generally indicate slight increases throughout the state, almost none are statistically significant, with the exception of the 24-hour duration at SeaTac, as illustrated on the previous slides. Now, statistical significance is an indication of how likely a sample statistic is to have occurred by chance. And in this case, it simply means that we are at least 95% confident that the means of the underlying populations are different by some amount. Skip that. Our investigation into the future examined 2 emission scenarios from IPCC's 2007 report on climate change. And Dennis covered a little bit before, but I'll just give a quick recap. There are a total of 4 families of scenarios, as depicted here. And in simple terms, the 4 scenarios combine 2 sets of divergent tendencies. one set varying between strong economic values, which is the A family, and strong environmental values, which is the B family, and the other set between increasing globalization, the one family, and increasing regionalization, which is the two family. The two that we analyzed were the A1 scenario and the A2 scenario. The A1 scenario is further subdivided into three storylines, and the specific one that we looked at was A1B. Now, the implications of these scenarios is, of course, the projected greenhouse gas emissions, and for our study, which investigated climatic projections to 2050, the emissions of each of the scenarios were essentially the same, as indicated by the white dotted lines here. There are only four families of scenarios, but there are some 20 global climate models that are used to simulate those scenarios. The two we looked at were the ECAM-5 and the CCSM-3. ECAM-5 was developed at the Max Planck Institute of Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, and was used in our study to simulate the A1B scenario. The CCSM-3 was developed at NCAR in Boulder, Colorado, and was used in our study to simulate the A2 scenario. And the models themselves are slightly more divergent than the scenarios that they are simulating. This figure from a report called Scenarios of Future Climate from the Pacific Northwest, prepared by the Climate Impacts Group in 2005, provides a general idea of how wet the future is predicted to be in this region under each model. Note that the y-axis here is percentage change in total annual precipitation and not precipitation extremes. But as you can see, both models predict slight increases in total precipitation. ECAM-5 is slightly more than CCSM-3, but both models are also pretty middle of the road in terms of overall future wetness. Now, the models themselves are run at the global scale, which has much too coarse of a spatial resolution to be useful, as Dennis mentioned. One of the major challenges in climate change research is downscaling these models. And the first type of downscaling that was done, which was performed by Eric Salathey and Rubili Jung for this report, was what's referred to as dynamical downscaling. That process entailed using the output from the global climate models as boundary conditions for regional climate models. And in this figure, representing changes in total precipitation under the CCSM-3 model in the month of February, you can see the vast improvement dynamical downscaling provides, with the regional model offering a much better representation of the topographic effects that are specific to this region. We took the precipitation output from the regional climate models and performed a similar analysis to that which was done in the historical analysis. The changes shown here are between the two time periods of 1970 to 2000 and 2020 to 2050, so roughly a 50-year difference between the past and the future. Not all of the results indicate increases, and you can see that the average one-hour storm intensity actually shows declines in both SeaTac and Spokane. But most do indicate increases, including four, which are statistically significant for differences in means. In order to see exactly how these changes in precipitation would be manifested in runoff, we wanted to use the output from the climate models as input to hydrologic models in two watersheds in the Seattle area. Unfortunately, even the downscale data is biased when compared to the observed data. And so before we could use it for hydrologic modeling, we had to once again downscale it, this time using a statistical rather than a dynamical approach. This procedure, which we refer to as bias correction, was performed at the grid point from each simulation closest to SeaTac and used to drive modeling of Thornton Creek in Seattle and Juanita Creek in Kirkland. The underlying principle in bias correction is that despite biases in the modeled data, projections may still prove useful if they are interpreted relative to the modeled precipitation of the past rather than the observed precipitation of the past. This schematic illustrates the procedure. The black wavy line on the left is the raw time series of data that comes out of the regional model for 2020 to 2050. Following the arrow to the right, each data point from that time series is plotted on the probability distribution of modeled precipitation from 1970 to 2000. This is then translated into a data point on the observed precipitation distribution with the same probability of occurring, which, following the arrow to the left, is then returned to its original place in the time series. And this was performed separately for each month in order to maintain the strong seasonality of patterns that exist in this region. Here are the results of bias correction are graphically shown for 24-hour annual maxima under the CCSM-3 model. The black is the observed and the red is the modeled after being bias corrected. The plots in the calibration period, which is 1970 to 2000, do not match exactly, but they are not supposed to match exactly. The means and the ranges, however, are roughly the same. This plot also illustrates the dramatic interannual variability present in the time series, along with the large precipitation events we've experienced in the last 6 years, which include three of the four highest 24-hour totals since 1949. And here are the results for the ECAM-5 model, showing a slightly more modest increase in future extremes, but again illustrating the dramatic year-to-year variability of annual maxima. The final step was to take the bias-corrected data and run the past and future time series through the model in order to compare the peak discharges under each. As mentioned before, we looked at two watersheds, Juanita Creek in Kirkland and Thornton Creek in northern Seattle, and derived time series of stream flows at the mouths of the creeks. The results showed increases in peak discharge for both watersheds under both scenarios, although statistically significant increases were only observed under one of the scenarios. The more modest increases at the mouth of Juanita Creek are partly the consequence of an extensive wetlands complex that serves to attenuate peak flows in that watershed. And the larger increases under the CCSM3 simulation are partly the result of an atypical characteristic of the particular simulation that we analyzed, which we called the November surprise. What we learned was that the CCSM3 model was actually run 5 times to simulate the range of natural variability that would be possible under a future climate. And although each simulation did indicate increases in extreme magnitudes, the particular simulation that we used showed the greatest increase in extreme magnitudes of all 5. And this was simply the luck of the draw. We had no control over which simulation we used, and we suspect that the people at NCAR had other good reasons for choosing this particular one. Furthermore, a month-by-month look at the precipitation projections revealed that the vast majority of future annual maxima came out of the month of November, a finding that was not replicated by the ECAM-5 results. This slide shows the change in total precipitation that is projected to occur for the CCSM3 model we used, with brown indicating decreases and blue indicating increases. The darker the color, the greater the projected change. And you can see that by far, the wettest future month is November. So not only are precipitation extremes higher in that month, but the concentrated increase in total precipitation has the effect of saturating ground conditions and exacerbating the increases in discharge that are projected. Thus, these particular results must be interpreted as the combined influence of systematic climate change and internal climate variability. So to conclude, few statistically significant changes in extreme precipitation have been observed in the last 50 years, with the possible exception of the Puget Sound. Simulations generally indicate increases in extreme magnitudes throughout the state over the next 50 years, but their projections vary by both model and region, and actual changes may be difficult to distinguish from natural variability. Nonetheless, hydrologic modeling of 2 urban creeks in the Seattle area suggests overall increases in peak annual discharge over the next 50 years. And before I wrap up, I just wanted to say a quick word about what the study does not address. It does not look into projections from the other 2 families of scenarios or the other 20-plus global climate models. It does not comment on what percentage of past trends was due to climate change and what percentage was due to climate variability. And indeed, based on other studies, there are indications that the results may have been different had we extended the analysis farther back in time. And it does not comment on the relative influence of changes in land use or more other complicated climate-related phenomena like rain on snow events. So what does this all mean? Can we make changes to our design standards based on the projections discussed here? Our conclusion is no. The range of these projections is too great, and our confidence in these projections is too low to predicate engineering design. In fact, the basing of design standards on future projections rather than past observations would require a fundamental shift in philosophy that we as a society may not be ready for yet. Humans are not particularly known for making accurate long-term predictions of the future, with the possible exception of Nostradamus. But we presented these results last week to a panel consisting of members from the Washington State Department of Ecology, Seattle Public Utilities, the EPA, and Snohomish County, and the dominant viewpoint was that our stormwater infrastructure is currently underperforming and in need of improvement and repair, regardless of climate change. The low-impact development strategies that are becoming more and more common for their environmental and hydrologic benefits, techniques like green roofs, permeable pavements, rain gardens, and pocket wetlands, are likely to be the most practical, economical, and effective ways of dealing with climate change as well. But accounting for future patterns of runoff is still a matter of risk. For large capital projects that must decide the most effective yet efficient sizing of facilities, the best we can say right now is that runoff is likely to increase. By how much, we don't really know, But robust cost-benefit analyses can help determine the best use of money over the project's intended design lives. I'd like to thank the other authors on this report, Dennis Lettenmeyer, Ann Steineman, Derek Booth, Pat Keyes, David Hartley, and Jeff Berkey, along with the Climate Impacts Group, the Washington State Legislature, Department of Ecology, and Seattle Public Utilities. Thank you.
We
chose, I'm sorry, the question was, why did we split the time series at 1980? Basically, we picked a length that most stations had records going back, which was about 50 years, and we just divided it in half. And it was pretty arbitrary, really. So. Yep. Yep, well, as Dennis mentioned, these are going to be available online, I think, at the Climate Impacts Group website. You can send me an email if you want. I can talk to you afterwards. But the executive summary is currently available of the report, and the more detailed chapters, I think, will be available pretty soon as well. If you go to the Climate Impacts Group, you should be able to find the executive summary. Mm-hmm. Over the Olympic rainforest? Lots of brown spots over the Olympic rainforest. Well, I guess it does show some brown spots in March and April. I mean, the seasonality of projected changes are pretty dramatic, and even though the overall magnitudes are going to be increasing, specific seasons don't show the same patterns. So, according to this simulation, it looks like the springs are getting drier, but the falls are getting wetter. And it just, yeah. That's.
So with those airport gauges, I remember hearing something that the SeaTac gauge got moved halfway through or built a new runway right next to it. Or have you checked sort of sighting distance to these few points?
The data at SeaTac was, the gauge was used, or moved, in about 1965 or so. And the data that we got was actually from Rick Palmer's group, who did some bias correction to the data to merge the two time series. And so it's the best guess that we have. And it's been used by a bunch of consulting firms in Seattle to do other hydrologic analyses. So it's the best guess we got.
I have a general question on how study look at the intensity of the events?
Uh-huh.
And you're suggesting LIV will deal with the intensity or the annual volume?
Well, both. The question is, will low impact development deal with the intensity or the annual volumes? And the annual volumes are, as Dennis mentioned, not projected to increase quite as much as the intensities are. But low, the constructed wetlands and the rain gardens and those types of things have shown really effective response at attenuating peak discharges. So I mean, there's a few examples in the Sea Streets, I think, up in northern Seattle, in which they've done some long-term studies and have found dramatic decreases in runoff, total runoff, and peak runoff. So that's my